My name's Kawenga. I'm an alcoholic. Took me 7 years in sobriety to be able to cry, openly or privately. Tonight I sat on the end of that table, and you know, the snot's running down my nose. As each one of us stood, that California, Alaska, Oklahoma, through the line. That means so much to me. Because I'm an alcoholic and I know what it's like to be lonely in a room full of 200 people. Lonely in my mother's arms. Lonely in the arms of a husband. I know that feeling. And here, you know, I was as nervous as a hooker in church. Tonight to come give this talk, and it was going through that roll call. You know, I've been out and had 3 cigarettes and gone to my room and prayed and changed my clothes, and I thought, this is endless. I'm never going to get through this up here and get it over with. And I was just nervous. I thought I was empty. You know, I worked with a couple of newcomers today, and I thought, you know, maybe I'm empty. Maybe there's nothing else to give. But when that roll call started, you know, it didn't matter that I'd gone to my room and said my prayers and smoked cigarettes and been afraid. It mattered that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it matters that I remember just how lucky I am. Because I'm not a woman that ever, you know, jumped up one morning and said, gee whiz, as soon as I find my underwear here in the Jolly Roger Motel. I'm going to spring into action and find God. Obviously, there are a number of us who identify. But when I got here, I didn't think you did. So if you're new tonight, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Do not try to understand it. Just love it. And if you can't do that, let us love you. You won't recognize love anyway for a while. The language of the heart, we're talking it here. That's why I didn't understand it when I got here. I am a woman who was born in Los Angeles, raised by 2 hardworking parents who didn't drink, and I have 2 perfect sisters. Ran the vacuum cleaner, had curtains on their windows. Their kids have manners. Their husbands did not throw them out on the freeway on Christmas Eve for some imaginary slight. They know how to make casseroles. And they layer them evenly, you know. They remember, and they put the cheese and then the meat. You know, they run the vacuum cleaner. Until I was like about 7 years sober and through my drinking, when it got time to vacuum, I moved. It was easier, you know, getting the boxes and leaving the wreckage behind for some other poor soul to clean up. That is the woman that God chose on June the 23rd, sometime in the morning of 1983, to give this gift to. Because I'm a woman who couldn't stop drinking. And that's what happened. I'm here to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. For those of us who have been here, you know, a little longer, we understand the 3. But I listened very carefully, personally, to what happened. Because when I can't make that connection, you know, when the wiring comes, slips a little loose, that conscious connection with God, with that higher power, I remember to go back to what happened. And I'm going to tell you what happened. And then if you want to debate the issue, you can talk about it, because I've studied my case a long time here. I have to believe that the gift was given to me so I can give it to you. And I have to believe that I was given this gift, and all the women and all the men and everybody who's come here has given me a piece of it. I didn't get it all at one time. I got a great big, like, sobriety quilt. Because when I go to a meeting, I may not get the whole problem solved. You know, I may just get a little piece. And I put it up there, and then I go to another meeting, I get another little piece. In 13 years, I got something that looks like a quilt started here, because all those pieces come together. That's why one of the reasons I go to meetings. The other reason is I go to meetings because I need to give this away, everything that's been given to me, so I can stay sober and not hyperventilate when I can't have a cigarette in a major hotel. But we love you here in Salt Lake. All the fellowships out in the parking lot out there out front. Even the ones who don't smoke are out there looking for the ones who do. We love each other here. Okay. End of, I swore I wouldn't do that, but I did it anyway. Born and raised in Los Angeles by these good, hard-working people. Went to work when I was 9 years old. Because everybody in my family went to work, we needed the money. Our family disease was poverty until I got a drink. And then it became alcoholism, I'll tell you. I hated growing up in Tahunga, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. It's where all the asthmatics and tuberculosis used to go to breathe good air. I was neither asthmatic nor tubercular. Little did we know I had a potential other problem. And I was a big, healthy, strapping girl, and felt like this family that I had fallen into just didn't, you know, they just weren't too tightly wrapped. They just didn't do it right. I no more felt, I loved, you know, my mom and dad, or I thought I did, but I just didn't feel comfortable with them. And my major objective was to get the hell out of Tahunga as quickly as possible, and I did. I had my first drink when I was 16 years old. I grew up in a household where there was no alcohol, and when you're living in a storefront or a public park or a trailer, 22-foot, your parents do not come home and say, let's have cocktail. They just don't do that. My father was a big Swede, and my mother, an American Indian. And I tell you that so that you can see what a Swede and an Indian produce. Tuck it away for future reference. In case you ever stumble across it again. Coffee. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I got the hell out of Tahunga. When I was 16 years old, I got a job that wasn't like frosting root beer glasses. Or working at the drive-in making sundaes. I got a real job in a factory. Oh, how wonderful. Thank you. I, somewhere last January, began to lose my voice with the flu. Many people said thank you in my own group. Anyway, I got this job in this factory, and I started making a little money. And on my first payday, the women I rode to work with were some older than I. And they said, we're going to stop at this place called the Bright Spot and cash our paychecks. I had never been in a bar. I didn't know what you called alcohol. My father's religious upbringing was in a, like a religious upbringing that didn't allow anything. You know, cigarettes, high-heeled shoes, radio, television, movies. They must have allowed that. Three times, because there were three of us. But that's it. So I'd never seen alcohol, and I didn't know what it was. And we stopped at this bright spot, and I fell in love with it. It was like a bar. I love bars. Last night, my heart was so touched when Patty said, I love the smell of a bar. I still do. You know, I'll be walking down the street being this spiritual giant, and I'll walk by one of those doors that's open early in the morning where that stale beer and the stale cigarettes and the cleaner from the men's room walking out there, and I think, I'm a bar drinker. And so that night I went into a bar and I climbed up on a red leatherette bar stool and I didn't know what to order. And I looked around to see what these women that were driving ordered. And they ordered beer and it came in brown bottles. And I looked at it wearing my bib overalls. Do you know what bib overalls are? Are they passive? They don't make Jordache bib overalls. Yeah. And I was tall at 16, and I was born with a big purple birthmark on the right-hand side of my face. And if I raised my arms real fast, the crotch would go. And I felt very uncomfortable most of the time. And looking like that and feeling like that, I climbed up on a red leatherette bar stool. And when I saw they ordered beer, I thought, not me. You know, I want to be Audrey Hepburn one day. And I looked around to see what other folks were drinking. And I saw a big, tall glass that looked elegant to where I'd come from. And it, you know, had little men with hats on and umbrellas and bananas and shooting out of it. And I said, I'll have one of those. And I did. I had nine of them. I drank them first because they tasted good. And I drank them secondly because somewhere between one and nine, that thing kicked in. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they call it the effect. And boy, did it, it was good. I had never had that effect before. And I knew it. I didn't stop and think, oh, this is affecting me. I just, like, felt it. And I liked it, so I just kept drinking. The way alcohol made me feel for a long time was, you know, if you don't like this birthmark, you don't like that I live in a storefront, and you don't like these bib overalls, you don't like these hand-me-down shoes from Aunt Merle, you don't like that I'm tall, just remember to bury me face down so you can always kiss my ass. And that is the way alcohol made me feel. And it is the way alcohol made me act. And it is in the book that we hear about the arrogance. The arrogance and the hurt and the anger and the resentment and the harm we do. And yet it made me feel so good. There's something a little wrong with somebody who feels good and feels that way, you know, like, because when I'm not drinking, I am not comfortable. And I don't like you much, but I'm very busy trying to keep you happy, even though I hate you. Because if I can just, you know, get you to love me and like me, I can get what I want, and I don't know what I want. So I got to stay on this treadmill. I got to stay on this treadmill. And the only way I can stay on that treadmill is to swing into the bright spot and have a couple of shooters to get my heart started and decide who I'm going to be that night in the big mirror. You know, the one that... and find him. And become whoever it is I'm supposed to be that night. The difference here is that 12 years and 7 months is, it is here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have begun to find the woman that God created and I rejected so long ago. I don't need a reason. I just did it. And as I just rejected her. I started being whoever it was they wanted me to be or he wanted me to be and doing whatever it took out of fear and anger and out of reality. It's not a lot of fun to have a birthmark. And people say, what's the matter with your face? I am not, darling. And I don't say, well, you see, I had a birthmark and I was born with it. I just go, now you got a little birthmark. Because you hurt me. And it wasn't until I got sober that I could say, I got hurt. And it wasn't justified. Well, really? And this world isn't always fair. And there's plenty wrong with it and the people in it. And what do I do about that? Well, I ask God for help. And once I've taken a part of these steps, I treat them like I am. I treat them like they were a sick friend. You know, I read that for a long time in that book. And what do you do when they step on your toes and treat you mean? Well, you just treat him like a sick friend. And I thought, that isn't enough. But after I'd done an inventory, and I had begun to look at some of the major problems with me, and what I had done to others, and finding out how they felt about it when I went to make amends, my sponsor told me, an amend doesn't sound like a telephone. It sounds like this. You got to look them in the eye and tell them just your part, you know? It's really hard. Their part is so much clearer. But it's in the action of doing that, not the prayer, not the fear you feel, not the lack of faith you feel. It's in the action of doing it that the faith comes along. And that sure thing that says, one more time, you know, I almost forgot to believe. One more time, I doubted the power that took a woman like me from behind a dumpster on Venice Beach and put her in the middle of 250 sober alcoholics in the Pacific group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the boot camp of AA. And thank you, God, for them. My first 6 years, I couldn't hit a bull in the ass with a handful of rice. And yet they took me in the way I was. And they said, just keep trucking here. Just do what everybody else does. Just get into action. And I'm going to talk some about that. I want you to know that I kept drinking and I got married. Poor devil. And I married a, like, academician. I used to say, and my sponsor said, get real. I married a teacher, and I thought that would make me respectable. And I bought him a lot of stuff, because by the time I was 23, I had a real stroke of luck. Somebody in the recording business thought I had a good ear, and I got a big job, and I came out of that factory, and I left Tahunga, and I quit drinking at the Bright Spot and Vince Dundee's Knockout. And I went to work in the recording business, and I was successful there, and I made a lot of money, and I bought, you know, I got rid of the bib overalls, and I had my shoes made. To hell with Aunt Merle and her nurse's Oxfords, handing them down, and I left my family behind, and I denied who they were. Until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never wanted you to know where I came from. And so I never told you. I created a new identity and a new spin on the ball. You know, these are the people that raised me. They didn't do anything wrong. But I just didn't want you to know where I came from. False pride, ignorance. Oh, that hurts my ego. And I did real good. And I started flying across this country and going to bed with other people's husbands and charming them. And a hotel room was real lonely at 8 o'clock in the morning with a note stuck on the mirror, see you next time. That isn't exactly romance, I don't think, or love, or comfort, or what God wanted for the woman he created in Coenga Begay or any one of us. But I didn't know any better. When you're drunk, you have trouble sorting that kind of philosophical stuff out. And I just couldn't go to bed unless I had a few shooters. I married a nice man and bought him a lot of stuff, and we were married 9 years, and I couldn't stop drinking. I wanted to be a wife, you know. I wanted to be like those other women, go home and, you know, put that casserole in the oven and have him smile. And it didn't work out that way because I made that drunk call home over and over and over again. Hi honey, I'm just gonna be a little late. We have a little extra work here at the studio, maybe 30 minutes. Don't hold dinner, but I'll be there. And I would go to one of those velvet sewers, you know, the ones with the velvet curtains and the naked lady over the bar, and the bartender wears a pinky ring and he uses a jigger. Never trust a bar where the bartender uses a jigger. I don't want to be there, you know. If you don't pour and drink like I do, I sure as hell don't want you monitoring my alcohol. But I went to better bars. You know, and they had a maid in the ladies' room. And I went, what do I need a maid in the ladies' room? I already know how to pee. And I don't wash my hands anyway, because I don't want to miss anything back there at, you know, Excitement Central. But he's slobbering and drooling, you see. But I went to better bars, because I thought it'd make me better. Like if you buy a better car, a better pair of shoes, and have your hair spun into curls by some imported person, and you have, you know, your massage at the office, and you have your nails glued on. Just a better person. Takes another half a quart of gin to believe that, but it's worth it. I drank myself out of the recording business. I drank up that marriage. My husband asked me to leave. It was in that marriage that, as a direct result of my drinking, I killed my child, my only child. And as a direct result of my drinking, I lost the capacity to ever have another child. I did not come to you. I didn't tap dance in here from the senior prom. I was 32 then, and well into alcoholism. We just didn't know. You know, I'd come home at 4 o'clock in the morning after I had seduced some little twerp at the bar. Little guys love me, but real little men, they do. And I would have told him enough lies, bought him enough drinks, and when the lights come on at 2 in L.A., you know, you're not ready to quit drinking. And we'd go out to my big car in the parking lot and live deeply. And then I'd just dump him, I guess, on the asphalt. I don't remember. And I would go home to a man I wanted to love me. And I can remember thinking 1,000 times, maybe this time he won't notice. He won't notice my bra hung on the rearview mirror. He won't notice it's 4 o'clock in the morning. He won't notice that my lips are bruised. He won't notice I smell funny. Maybe this time he won't notice. Well, he noticed and didn't say anything until we'd been married 9 years. And on the 2nd of January, he said to me, simple stuff, because we didn't know there was a program called Alcoholism, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. We did not know there was a program called Al-Anon. We just didn't know. And he said, you know, Tiger, it's interesting. That was his nickname for me. You know, Tiger, I think we ought to hang up the spikes, because I can't live with you the way you are. The way you are. He couldn't put it into words. He wasn't a mean man. He wasn't a petty man. He wasn't an alcoholic. And he didn't know how to put this into words. That's another reason I'm here tonight. Nobody that's not one of us knows how to put this into words. That's why one drunk talking to another drunk works. That's why today I went out to the fellowship facility in the parking area and lit my cigarette and started looking for another drunk. And I found one. And I believe whether she's here tonight, I don't know if she's here tonight, but if she is, I want to, before I forget, thank the committee for allowing those who didn't eat here to come for the meeting. I don't like conferences where the doors are shut while they serve the whatever. I can never identify what it is, but it's good. But I, you know, the chicken or the ham. I like those. That's okay for us who can have, you know, a nice dinner. But when the meeting starts, everybody carries the message and everybody is here. This is a fine committee of sober women who've worked a year to do this. But especially because I, you know, have a nasty streak that we're working on. And I'd say, open those doors. How come all of us are here with the chicken and the other alcoholics are out in the face? But they handled it right. And I thank them for that. It makes me feel good. And I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad all of us are here. But it's that one drunk talking to another drunk. And I spent a couple hours doing that. Telling my one-on-one in my hotel room, women like me, where we could smoke. And and we did, and we talked. And we talked, and we listened. And when she left, you know, I was able to do what was done for me. I gave her a pack of cigarettes. No, there's a story about that. If Diane is here tonight from the Pacific Group, it's my Judy R. story. See, I was given everything I needed, And it wasn't handed to me like charity, because I'm a drunk. It was handed to me in the real sincere wisdom of another alcoholic, just knowing that I couldn't afford cigarettes. That I had 76 cents, and I needed to eat. And it was done for me for a whole year. When I got sober, this woman named Judy R., in that group, my home group then, would every Monday night come to the Monday night meeting, and she would come down the aisle, and she would say, "Coenga, isn't this your brand of cigarettes?" She was 6 years sober, and I was like 6 months sober. And I'd say, "Yes." She'd say, "You know, I pulled the wrong knob on the cigarette machine. These aren't my brand." And so I'd have cigarettes for the week. When I was a year sober and thought I knew something, she did that one Monday night. And when she walked away, I said to my buddy, who had 30 days less than me, "I hope when I'm 6 years sober, I'll be able at least to pull the right button on the cigarette machine." We welcome you if you're new here tonight, and we understand you, for we have been new. And we understand, one drunk. On June the 23rd, 1983, I found myself behind the steering wheel of my car, in a car with two dogs and a Siamese cat. We had been sort of vacationing for about 7 or 8 months. We were at Venice Beach in Los Angeles, behind a dumpster in a parking lot behind the L&L Market at Rose and Oceanfront Walk. It's a tricky area. We didn't stand out, I'll tell you. If you've ever been to Venice Beach. The night before, I had done some things up Speedway Alley. See, when they broadcast it on TV and show you the roller skaters and the funny people, that's for the tourists. 50 yards back, there's an alley. It's called Speedway Alley. Runs parallel to Oceanfront Walk on Venice Beach. And that's where the real business takes place. The residents. And that night, and a number of other nights, I had done some stuff up that alley that I was never taught to do, I wasn't raised to do, and I would have looked down my nose at anybody who did when I was on the high side of my drinking. But I did those things for the promise of a drink. If you've been out on that street or in a bar, and you need a drink, and you don't have any more money, you know what I'm talking about. Just the promise of a drink. And I didn't get it that night. I had reached a point in my drinking where I needed it. I needed it to quit, you know, like chewing my tongue. I needed it so I wouldn't, I used to like hyperventilate. I needed it to quit shaking and to have that fear, whatever, you know, that panic in me calm down enough to get up and get ready for the day and go out and get the real stuff done, the drinking. I lived through a lot. I went to a lot of psychiatrists. I lived on the high side and the low side. I got married. I killed a kid. I did a lot of stuff, big time and little time, if we're going to measure it according to the terms of the world that we live in. not according to the terms and the way of life and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fourth dimension, not according to those terms. But I didn't know any better. That morning I woke up and I needed a drink. I'd been up to Esalen, you know, when I still had a little money, because I knew something was wrong. It's up in Northern California, you know, on the cliffs over that beautiful ocean. And they go up there and they're supposed to be able to fix you. And I went up there to get fixed. They gave them $10,000 to fix me. And I drove up to the Enchanted Forest and parked my car and went in and put me in a white toga, put little flowers in my hair, went barefoot, ate bean sprouts and brown bread. And they said, now what we're going to do here is you're going to take your problem and put it in the chair and talk to it. And then you're going to get in the chair and become the problem, and it's going to talk back to you. You know that feeling like you've made like a severe error? I very quietly flipped my toga up and I went looking for the refund desk. I'm willing to tell them anything. I think I'm having an attack of some exotic disease and I got to go home, and you got to... They don't have a refund desk there. And I didn't know what my problem was. I had not done an inventory. I had not talked to another sober alcoholic. I had never darkened the door of an AA meeting. I mean, you would go there. Little men in raincoats with rubber boots and a bulb hanging over a oilcloth table. We have a lot of old ideas, conceptions that we're going to have to let go of. But I didn't know about AA, never darkened the door. And they wanted me, I gave them $10,000, and they want me to talk to my problem? If I knew what the hell my problem was, I would not have given you $10,000. Didn't tell them that, don't want to piss them off. I was there about 3 days, you know, and I looked around, and other people were getting better. They were floating in those hot tubs, and om. And they were, you know, wearing those little yellow faces with the smile on it. They had just come out to have a happy day. I hate those things. Still hate them. And they were happy. And they were hugging each other and kissing. And you know, it was 3 days. I was as crazy as I ever want to be. Just as crazy. They don't drink there. And I left there for a few minutes and found a liquor store in the Enchanted Forest. And I got me a half a gallon of vodka, and I went back up there, and I got centered like the rest of them. I could not stop helping them. Let me show you how to put your problem in the chair. What are you doing? You know. It was driving home from there. But the reality, see, I didn't bottom out in a car behind a dumpster. I bottomed out driving away from there with the sure knowledge that I was unfixable, that it was always going to be this way, that whatever the hell was wrong with me was so wrong that it wasn't going to get any better. I was going to feel like this till the end. That is called despair. And hopelessness. And I felt it driving an imported car down Highway 1. It was then that I went in and packed my little whatever ladies like me packed to go down to Venice Beach and be a free spirit and play the flute to the sunset and pack my dogs and my cat in there, and that's what we did. This is not a hot flash. Pass through those. During my detoxing, we never were able to separate it.
But it's over. Thank you. I bottomed out doing that. And I went home, packed those two dogs and that Siamese cat up in a car. And I said, screw it. The phone's been turned off. I can't make the payment on the mortgage. The light, who cares about the light bill? And I've been sleeping in the garage because I'm afraid to go in the house for the last 3 or 4 months. I'll just split, you know. We call it a geographic. Just screw it. And so I went to Venice Beach to be a free spirit. I was there about 7 or 8 months, in and out, on and off that spot. And on June the 23rd, 1983, after working that alley that night before, I woke up. And it was a June morning, overcast, and I was sitting at the steering wheel of my car. Now we get to where the rubber hits the road. You tell me, if there is no power, if there is not a God, then you tell me why this happened. I woke up, and I needed a drink, and I sat behind that steering wheel, and a thought came to me, and it was, never darken the door of an AA meeting. Thought it was rubber boots and raincoats beneath me, because I had a deeper problem. Don't know what it was, but it couldn't be my drinking. And a thought came to me, and the thought was, maybe if you went to Alcoholics Anonymous, you could learn how to panhandle. And that, that's what arrogance will do for you. And then if you could panhandle down here on the beach, you could get a little fix, you know, a little money together. And I'd forgotten that I had about 3 strands of hair left. My hair had been falling out. And get yourself together, you know, and get your booze even. And so, but I had no idea where Alcoholics Anonymous was. And if you had told me that 2 sober women would come and take me with them, Jonestown had just happened, I would have thought, and so I didn't know where to go. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I had no idea where you were in a town where I'd lived all my life. And a thought came to me when I was making it one of my periods of progress. I lived up in Bel Air, and there's a street called Sepulveda where you drive on a run. I'd have to run out sometimes when the liquor store would get pissed off at me. And I would drive down Sepulveda, and there's a stop at the corner of Ohio Street and Sepulveda. Sometimes I'd make it. Did I hear her right? You bet. See, and I would look out of the corner of my eye, and I'd see this little yellow house, no advertising, no marquee, no message blinking, and all kinds of people going in and out of there. And sitting in that car, I thought, maybe that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe that's where it is. For the 11 Western states, of course. It takes a minute to get underway. And I headed for Ohio and Sepulveda. It's about a 20-minute drive from where I had chosen to spend my time. And I don't remember much of that day. I started early in the morning, maybe 8 or 9, I don't remember. And I got to the meeting, the Monday night meeting of the Pacific Group at the Ohio Street Clubhouse at 8:30 that night. I didn't drink. I found that place. You ever get lost in your soul, lost in your heart? Just lost. Sober? Don't forget. There's a power here. And God's plan
He gave me a free will. But sometimes you don't have any will left. It makes it a little easier when you get here. But I didn't have anything to do with remembering that place or how to get there. Nor did I think you could help me solve my problem. And this June, the 23rd, I will put that same outfit on that I got here in. Because I don't want to ever forget, you know, where I came from. I'm a woman who spent a lot of time trying to look good because I came from poverty and I thought it'd make a difference. Because it's also rotten inside. And yet I came to you in a pair of black pajama bottoms, urine soaked, and a blouse with no buttons on it. One button. Taking all the other buttonholes, put them up there. Look good. I had no underwear because I lost it. No. I had no underwear, it just got too complicated. I was wearing a pair of high-heeled stimulators. This was a little band across the jaw. The queen of Venice Beach. And the heel was gone on one. And I was trying to walk like you wouldn't notice, you know. I had 11 teeth, all critically spaced. And I had, you know, my hair was a very touchy issue. When we finally got it clean, we had to cut the wrap out of it, and we learned that it was falling out. And I said to this woman who became my sponsor, my hair, when I brush my hair, it falls out. She said, quit brushing it, you only have 3 strands left. When I had cancer and I was sober, I went to her and I said, I'm so depressed. She says, wear bright colors. I have to assume that you're praying, that you have a conscious contact with God, that you've taken these steps, that you have found the power, and if you haven't, wear bright colors and start praying, start working those steps. I walked up to the front door of the Monday night meeting of the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a guy standing there, he's still sober, and you know, he was really clean. I hadn't had a bath in like maybe 6, 8 months. And I looked funny and I smelled funny because I was. And I was dirty. And he had on a Harris tweed jacket and a power tie and slacks you could slice cheese with. Creases, you know, and a pair of wingtip shoes and a mouth full of white teeth. He looked like he'd eaten a piano, you know. Half my age. And he did something that I try to do and that I teach my babies to do. He put his hand out to me just the way I was. Just the way I was. You know, I had a baby walk up to me about 2 months ago and she said, and I said, oh, please. What is it? Miss Serenity here. I said, what has upset you? And stop snorting. And she said, I smell alcohol. Somebody in here has alcohol. I said, are you at the wrong address? You know, this is the wrong party. I used to do that. It's what we do. Until the power.
till some drunk, like my first sponsor, walks up to me in that meeting that night. I walked into that room, you know, this guy shook my hand and like shot me through this little narrow door. Didn't want to lose me. Into a room full of 250 like sober alcoholics, all talking at the same time, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And I thought, uh-oh, where's the, you know, like the oilcloth table and these guys that I can con a little and get a little something moving here. This is not it. This looks like a bunch of Methodists here. And just as soon as they start square dancing, I'm out of here. When the potluck comes out, I'm gone. And I really meant that, but I didn't want to upset them. And I thought, man, I'd just slip out, but they wouldn't let me slip out. Those women came at me. Here's my phone number. Well, I'm living in a car. What the hell are you giving me your phone? I didn't say that. I just put it in my wet pocket. The end of that meeting, we're still on what happened here. We're still on it. You know, I beat in the Wango machine because it works. God works. God works when you don't have any more strength to debate the issue and explain to him where he's wrong and what you want. And I had reached that point. I was just lucky that day. After this meeting, I thought, I'm out of here. I'm just going to be real careful and go to that French door and just leave. They won't notice. Everybody's going, hi. This woman, 15 years sober, just walked up to me, just everything jingling. You know, she had one of that energy that we get when we stay sober. We don't realize we have it. And we like, it's like radiating off of us. And when you're as sick as I was, you just think, she just walked up to me and she said, here's my name and my phone number. And I thought, great. I thought, just keep them calm till you get out of here and get in that car with the two dogs and the Siamese cat. They were already out the back door feeding the dogs cheese. They didn't have to sleep in that car with those dogs. I did. But that's the way we are. We are loving people, and they were kind to my dogs. And they gave him cookies. For a long time, my dogs ate off the refreshment table. And I didn't know it. See, we take care of you here because somebody took care of us. We don't have it in us anymore to hurt you or to make fun of the way you do your hair or what you're wearing tonight. Because I haven't bought a dress yet, but I'm working on it. I have worn hand-me-down clothes. I have trusted in a power greater than I because I had some amends to pay off. Back to that meeting, this little lady walked up to me and everything's moving. She's got bracelets on and earrings and everybody's saying, good night, man. And I thought, there's just one more little step here and I get the hell out of here. And she said, here's my name and my phone number. And she said, why don't you meet me at a meeting tomorrow night at 26th and Broadway? Now, I have this little thing about me that when you tell me something dumb or that I think is dumb or something I don't want to hear, I have a little curl to my lip, a little toss of my three strands of hair. And it happened. And she carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. One drunk talking to another. And if you think about it, each one of us someone has carried it so that we could hear it. And it's been carried in every language. Alabama language. Ohio. No, there's the language in every state. I've learned that. But it's in the words. It is the language of the heart. It is the message that I could hear. And somehow this power, this one that we just have to think about and just doubt, and I'm not sure, and maybe I, that power that did this to me. And that's why I'm here to tell you about it. Put this woman in front of me, and when I curled my lip, she did not hug me and give me a chocolate cookie and a neck rub. She gave me what I needed. Me, Cahuenga. Not you or Julie or Mary, the way I could hear it. And there has to be some power greater than any of us to connect like that over and over and over and over again in every state, now in every country, to anybody, even somebody like me. She said, why don't you get your head out of your ass? Do you know who you're talking to, Ed? I may not look so good, but I got to tell you what I used to be. You don't know. I didn't say that. I was appalled. That's a new word for pissed off. I just thought, stunned, because she called the shot. She said, and here are the words, why don't you get your head out of your ass? For I believe you may be an alcoholic woman like me. She took it to herself, like me. And you can tap dance out of here in that little outfit you got on and go on feeling the way you're feeling and doing the stuff you're doing and living the way you're living. Or you can meet me tomorrow night at a meeting at 26th and Broadway, and you just might feel some better. She did not wait for me to debate the issue. She didn't wait to sell it to me or to promote it or to convince me that I was going to die or to explain to me how wonderful she really was. She just turned on her little Denny's and split. Two things happened that night. I did not return to Venice Beach. I never have again. And I did not drink, nor have I had a drink since that night. That's what happened. And what am I like today? My sponsor, I didn't know you could choose a sponsor until I was about 4 months sober. I thought this woman had assigned herself to me. I thought they did that. I thought somebody in the back room said, you get the one in the wet pack. Thank God, because this woman meant business. She just didn't mince words, you know. She just got it right out there for me. And the interesting thing for all of us to remember, and I try to remember, is that the next night, I spent all day the next day on a resentment, because I was going to find that little old lady and explain to her who the hell she was talking to here. And that energy, you know, that thing that keeps us up and ready to drink and ready to get in a fight and ready to destroy ourselves. One more time. I found that place. It took me all day the next day, but I found it. And I stormed into that Tuesday night meeting. And I want to tell you what, that was not a regular meeting of hers. She was there. She was there early. She was waiting for a woman. The odds are anywhere, a woman like me, not going to show up. But she said she'd be there. And she was. And when I got there, I had started really to, what I didn't know you called it then, was like detox. I needed a drink, and I was sweating and very nervous and very angry. And just, you know, I had a little armor in my back car, the back of my car, but I thought, I can't bring that. So I came down that aisle, and here's what she gave me. I don't see one up here. Oh, we do have one. Isn't it nice? We have a big book here tonight. She had a can of Pepsi-Cola, straight stuff with sugar in it. Not a bottle of Evian or a diet Snapple. I needed sugar. I needed lots of sugar. I needed 12 Pepsis a day for 3 years. I didn't know that. I hadn't had a Pepsi in my life. And she has a Pepsi-Cola in her little Irish hand. And this. Give me a break. I'm not into the, you know, murder mysteries. There I... Because I can't focus. I cannot get my eyes on the page. And I can't stop feeling like I want to hurt somebody and like I want to die. She didn't care. She said, drink this, and she handed me this can of Pepsi-Cola, read this, sit down, and try not to talk so you don't embarrass yourself. This is the woman who heard my inventory, who took me through those steps, who said, yes, you have to go to that man and tell him, you embezzled $22,000 and you're willing to pay it back $5 a month. And yes, I had disappeared. I was a missing person for 13 years from my family. My mother and my father and my sisters went to bed every night wondering where I was. And it was not like they live in Australia, you know, because I got pissed off at them. They didn't understand either. I couldn't win them over. When I got sober, Mary Ann said, the first thing you got to do is find your parents. Because look what you did. Look in that inventory. No matter who they are, they went to bed every night. Got television, they find a body. We're always finding bodies in California. You know, have you noticed, like, we found another body today in Mojave, and you think of your friends. No, it couldn't be Helen. You know, we're always digging them up out there. And my mother and my dad went to bed every night looking at TV. They had to explain to the people they knew and to other members of the family when they would say, well, I like Prince Coringa. We don't know. You can only lie for 7 or 8 months, make up stories for 2 or 3 years. We don't know. Every night, your eldest daughter talked to me about a tornado roaring through the lives of others. Didn't know. I thought, they'll still be up in Tahunga, that place I hate. They weren't there, and nobody knew where they were. And I got down on my knees after 3 months. Marion says, you got to find them. And I said a prayer one Sunday. After I'd been up to Tahunga and looked for him, and I tried to, and I says, please help me. That's what I said. And thought came to me, said, my baby sister's brother-in-law, he was like an old maid, sort of. And I thought, you know, he used to live in Burbank, and I bet he's still in the phone book, and maybe he will know. I dreaded somebody telling me your parents are dead. And I called him. Nobody ever forgets my voice. And not for years. Because cigarettes and whiskey do this to your voice. If you start out a little low anyway. He knew my voice. And he said, oh, have you called your mother and father? You know, that's a gift. That's an amend that I thought, oh, God, I don't have to... try to remember them the way they were and not let them know I don't drink anymore and not let them know that I love them. I just don't know how to show you and let them know I'm living a respectable life. and let them know I'm just not quite like them, but that I tell the truth, and that I'm not going to drink anymore, and that I'm sorry for all those years, but I'm going to amend my life, and I'm going to call you every week, Mother, and listen and not tell you how wrong you are, even when you're wacko. I'm going to send you a card on Mother's Day and your birthday and Christmas. And I'm going to do the same thing for Daddy. And I'm going to find my younger sister and I'm going to tell her, you know, Mom and Daddy are good and I'm sorry I wasn't here for you when you were growing up. I got nieces and nephews I didn't know I had. Fine kids. The last amend was to a sister that had a horse fall on her. The pretty one, you know, my mom always just say to her, oh, Ruthie, you're so pretty. Kawenga's smart, but you're just so pretty. And I just hated her. So we never developed a close relationship. Staying sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Carrying the message, washing coffee cups, sponsoring people. Telling them my story. The way, you know, I told Marianne, the way I tell you, and them telling me their story, entrusting to me their secrets, and losing, you know, killing a kid. Where would I ever consider that to be useful? Well, by God, we bring everything in here, and everything we did is useful. We can always share it. There's somebody else out there. No matter how we harm somebody, no matter how we hurt, no matter how bad we thought it was, because it's an asset. It's something I can sit in a room with upstairs and tell another girl what I did and how I live today. That sister got, you know, she got crushed by a horse, and she's in a wheelchair, and she is not an alcoholic, and she doesn't take pills. And this program works. If I carry these principles into my family and into where I work and into the market, where I just get so pissed off at those little bag boys who throw the potatoes on top of the bread, and I carry the principles in, and I have carried without knowing it, without knowing it. My sister called me at Christmas. I drove up that icy canyon. I'm scared to death of ice. I like to drive about 80 miles an hour, and you can't do that, aren't I? And I want to get there, you know. I don't want to inch along. But I went and picked her up, and I brought her into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought her to my sponsor's home on Christmas Day, that sister that I could never develop a relationship with, paralyzed in a chair, and still pretty. And I called ahead and I said, Pat, can I bring my sister Ruthie? She said, it's about time. You know, it's been a long time. It's about time. And my sister says, well, you know, I got to sit on a pad and I never know when I have to urinate. I have this bag. I said, you'll fit right in. And I meant it. And she says, well, you know, I got to have access, and somebody's got to lift me. Like, I said, no problem. The problem is this ice. We got to, you know, get there. She came into a room full of people in varying degrees of sobriety. And she ate whatever we had, turkey, and my sponsor's husband is the cook, and I'm never quite sure. It's always good. And she sat among us. She had never seen me sober. My mother has never seen me take a cake. I've asked her, and we've offered to drive her. Somehow in my mother's heart, it's hard for her. She just tells people up there where she lives, oh, you know, my daughter does charity work in L.A. But she has seen the change. You've taught me how. That sister, that night driving back up that mountain after all these drunks, you know, I drove up in about 3 of the young guys that Luther sponsored, he just picked her up, and she's a tall girl, like, just slung her into that chair and whipped that chair up that, you know, patio, and we shared without knowing what we've got here, what we've been given, this power that we carry with us everywhere, if just every morning and every night we take a look at our life and clean it up. You bet I was wrong today. I'm sorry. You know, yep, I didn't tell you the truth, and I got to do that. We don't know. We think that's sometimes nickel and dime stuff. We think, you know, no. My sister called me just before, you know, I call her now every Sunday. And she said, you know, I tried a lot of different religions. I won't list them. And Satanism, and that extraterrestrial stuff. And like when you go back in lives and the Ouija board. But she says, you know, I've known you since we were kids, and I never heard such humility and such simplicity when you said there either is a God or there isn't, and there damn well better be one, or my ass is dead. And I have come to know there is a God as I understand him. As I understand him, as we italicized and underlined. My sister, you know, has begun to think that perhaps there is a power. Perhaps she can take her art. She started to paint with her mouth, and then she got one hand moving. She began to believe you don't have to live in a canyon 250 miles away. I hope I can carry what you've given me to her on a regular basis. What do? I work. I have a job. I have a car. I sponsor a number of women. And I could talk about all the things that's happened to me sober for two more hours, but we wouldn't get to cha-cha-cha and have our cigarette. All I can tell you is what I've told you is the truth. I came here clean and neat. What you see here is what you get. And I told you my story so you'd know what happened. Because on those sure low spots ahead, on those down days, on those days when I can't pull that Smith & Wesson K-22 and explain to the world, I can take out that big book and remember that when I got here, I was having trouble with personal relationships. I was like prey to misery and depression. I had a like sense of uselessness. Like I couldn't seem to get ahead. Like I wasn't living sober. And like there wasn't a God who's in my corner, no matter what, who's rich and powerful. That's the guy I always look for in the bar. And who loves me the way I've always needed to be loved and been afraid to ask for. Stay with it, even on those low spots ahead. Everyone's been here for me. Cancer of the nose, joblessness, anger, arrogance, fear, and living sober. God love you all. He loves me and he loves you. We are the luckiest women in the world.